Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Right, okay. So, good morning, and for those of you out there in YouTube land, whatever time of day it is for you. So, Russ, it is an absolute pleasure to see you here at a conference. It's been a while,
yeah,
and not just for pandemic reasons, but you've got a fresh new talk with a great new title.
Thank you.
Tell it. Yeah, so the talk is Don't Feed the Pigeons. And I remember we had a chat about, you were earlier in the year we were talking and you came around. So first of all, what's it about?
Sure. Okay. So before I launch into what the talk itself yesterday was about, I want to say something very quickly just to embarrass this man, because not only am I a fanboy wearing the T-shirt, what Kevin's alluding to is I was very ill a few years ago. And during that period of time, a lot of people find it very difficult to get in contact because they don't know what to say, because they may have experiences of their own that overlap with it. There's lots of good reasons why it can be very isolating. And Kevin was one of the few that didn't isolate from me at all, although it was COVID time, so come on. Kevin was calling me up saying, let's talk writing and tech. And it meant the absolute world. So before we get rolling, can I give a little round of applause for Kevin?
If it helps, I still don't know what to say.
You did at the time, honestly. You took me out of myself, and it was so appreciated. It really was.
In which case, we will touch on that, because your talk yesterday was a personal journey, as well as you connected, as it were, person, people, and tech. I wish tech began with a P, because that would be really good. Person, people. First of all, the headline, what was it about, and why is it called Don't Feed the Pigeons?
So it's Don't Feed the Pigeons. Actually, it came from a quote from from Allah. Allah was my boss, the place I'm at the moment, when I joined. Sadly, no longer my boss, because she's an incredible person, but she had a great opportunity elsewhere, so she headed off. But this is one of those phrases she used to me when I was figuring out what platform engineering could be. And her guidance was pretty much along the lines of, don't double down on the things that you don't want to have, the stories you don't want to encourage. Don't embrace those as well. It'd be very tempting as a product engineer to listen to the users and the people, you know, using what you're going to try and provide, and go, well, how do we help them do more of that? How do we help them smile more about that particular thing? Without always, you don't always ask yourself, should they be doing that? Is that a good thing? Things like in the early days of building these products, I would get comments and feedback along the lines of, please don't take Terraform away from me. And in fact, Terraform was a major contributor to cognitive load and things that they didn't need to think about. But by Don't Feed the Pigeons, I was like, okay, let's not focus on how we help people become excellent with Terraform, even though that's what they would like. Let's go and dig into why. What is their story? Back to one of the themes of the talk, which is the data wasn't enough. I had the sort of snippet of, please don't take my Terraform away from me. When I spoke to that person, where he was coming from was more along the lines of, don't make my skills get rusty. Don't give me a special thing that only works here. Because if I go somewhere else, I'm going to interview somewhere else, and my career is important to me. And I got that. I understood that. And after a lovely conversation over a coffee, I think it was, I realized this wasn't about Terraform at all. This was about delivering a platform experience which empowered the people that use it, the development teams that use it, to do better work than they've ever done before on things that they care about as much as anything else. And we got around the whole Terraform thing, we got around by making it an inner open source model. Mm. So the Terraform never went away. It got a lot better. It got less kind of cut, you know, copy paste, everyone's flavor slightly different. But it wasn't the primary interface, mm. and it wasn't the primary burden on people's lives every day. And so we delivered on the cognitive load drop, as well as not taking away the things that mattered to that person.
I think that there's a very interesting point there that you make, which I think is bigger than platform engineering. In fact, is fundamental to how we should be approaching technology, which is, as you describe it, somebody comes to you, they say, you know, please don't do this, or please do this. Mm. It's either one, it doesn't really matter. And it's never about what it's about. They say it's about this. Mm. In this case, it's about Terraform. Mm. It's about this tool. It's about this. And it's just like, it's not about that. Yeah. There's always something else. And sometimes people are offering you perhaps what might be considered, in their mind, they're giving you a solution, but they haven't articulated the problem and the narrative that led up to their understanding of that. And that seems to be pervasive. And actually, that was present in your talk yesterday. It was very refreshing because normally when people are talking about platform engineering, they are definitely coming in from a strong technological anchor, that is the center of what they're talking about. So I'm going to ask you, what do people normally define as platform engineering? And how is that not quite right?
Right and wrong, Kevin. You've left a trap for me.
Yeah, absolutely. There it is. Yeah.
Like an enormous amount of history in this industry, we tend to go in with, we need more tech and tools. Right? We absolutely need more tech and tools to make something happen. The older I perhaps get, and I'm no spring chicken anymore in this industry, the more I realize that we say everything's a people problem. It's kind of a cliched phrase. And then we throw tech at it. Yeah. and new standards and not bad ideas. None of these things are bad. The issue for me is I tend these days to come from, well, what is the behavioral change we're looking for? What does... I talk about OODA loops a little bit in the talk. For those that aren't familiar with OODA loops, it's the John Boyd part of Simon's talk, so now I'm double referencing to yesterday. But it's about observing, orient, and decide, and act. It was basically, Boyd's position was, if you're in a dogfight, the faster your OODA loops, the better you would be able to respond to the conditions that were happening. I focus on OODA loops when it comes to platform engineering, because I focus on what are the loops that help the people using the platform make better decisions, perform better actions. There's a lot you could provide, there's a lot you could make available, and there's a lot of great work going into API first development and focusing on APIs and PaaS and this sort of thing for platform engineering, and none of that is bad. I don't start there, is the major difference. I start from, is there a loop that is going to empower a group of people without feeding the pigeons, helping them be better, helping them be incredible? And I talk about this in sort of a morphed hierarchy of needs that I look at. So we start with the baseline of identifying that there is a platform at all. It's helpful. Scoping that, then you look at security, reliability, sort of table stakes for a platform. And I call it table stakes because every platform has a trust relationship with the people using it. Because you're asking them to give something up. Some direct control is going away. And so you're saying, trust us, we've got this. So I put a lot of effort into those lower levels, not from I love the tech in them, but because I don't want to lose the trust. Mm. If anything, I want to amplify it. And then I look at the higher levels of what are the OODA loops that are helping these people do what they really need to do really well, really quickly, confidently. And it comes from a very simple belief that software engineering is a creative discipline. It's one reason I like it anyway. If it wasn't, I'm not sure. I did work in a factory once. I want to point this out. Worse than that, right? I worked in a beauty products factory. I had to wear a hairnet. This is how long ago it was. And so I've seen what factory work feels like, and I always hated the factory metaphor for software development. It was something that was very big for a while. And I was like, no, you do not want to make that happen. But it's creative. That doesn't mean it has to be woolly, but it changes the OODA loops you provide to people. If you want to help them be creative, you give them all of the safety to be confident to take risks and be creative. So that's the balance I always look for, is where's the sweet spot where people are able to be creative confidently on their products, on the things they want to build, rather than having to be sort of navigate the dark and beastly areas of the map that contain infrastructure and other bits and pieces that we prefer wasn't foremost in their mind.
I think, yeah, that was, so starting from let me relate that to something else you talked about, which I found resonated with me very, very deeply. You refer to habitat a lot. And I think this is one of the lost parts of the software architecture metaphor. When people often talk about software architecture, it is structural, and you know there's nothing intrinsically wrong with it, but it's kind of missing the bit when we borrow the metaphor that architecture is ultimately for people. It is to create a space that is habitable. It is a habitat. It is where I'm going to live and work. Effectively, you're creating a space for people to live and work in.
Yeah.
And that's a huge responsibility, but it is not. But normally when people approach it, they are saying, we need concrete beams, we need microservices, we need this, that, and the other. This is like, no. What's the feeling of the space? What kind of space would you like to make it? And that, I found, was a refreshing kind of perspective, because that is a bit, for me, when people talk about software architecture, that's kind of missing. And it has, to me, I think, been missing a little bit from the platform engineering discussion.
I think so. I think there's two major groups that are inhabiting that space of platform engineering at the moment. There's the groups that are coming from something of an operational infrastructure, DevOps automation background, and they are doing an incredible job of saying there are things we need in this space that are going to help us achieve a better building. Then there are the product, you know, technical product owners or product stewards, I love that phrase for it, that are trying to curate the experience of consuming it and maintaining it. And that's where I sometimes have an issue with some architectural diagrams, and by that I mean PowerPoint diagrams, right? Everyone's seen these.
Marketecture.
Exactly. Yeah. Where you've got these blocks, and then you've got people.
Somebody says, here is our architecture.
Yeah. And the people are always around the outside, okay? So there's like, this person's interacting here, and this person's interacting here. And there's often a two-way arrow, which means we don't know what that looks like, okay? But that's where I live. I live in that gap. I don't want to get too Steve Jobs on this line, the intersection of people and technology. But I'm living in that place because that's where the value is. Everything else could be beautiful. But if that two-way arrow is a meaningless, you know, afterthought, then you lose. It's not, you know, you've not provided something that's helped someone's life. So that's why I focus on the OODA loops, is they are the things that help me navigate what should go in those two-way arrows, those meaningless two-way arrows. And I love the OODA loop because I know it's an overused term in our industry. It's been around for so many years. But it does remind you that a decision is supposed to happen. So one of the things I did, little story for you, when we were working early doors on our platform at the moment, is we'd forgotten a community of users. We'd forgotten the product owners. We'd taken along all of the product engineering teams, and we were talking to them about how they would need to use various compute platforms and everything else. And then someone said, yeah, but we've got this strange dynamic of having mandated 25% time to product owners to do technical stuff. And in that is a bug. It's an organizational bug. Because what you're saying is the product owners don't understand the technical priorities. Worse than that, you're saying they're not educated enough to do it. So you're taking it away from them. And so what we're trying to do, and it's an organizational change, this is why platform engineering is so exciting, is we're nowhere near done yet, but we're beginning to build those OODA loops for those product owners. We're helping them become technical product owners. owning the whole product, being able to understand what the resiliency characteristics of their product is, what are the security characteristics, where are the trade-offs. It's an enormous challenge because most product owners haven't come from a perspective of ever having to understand those things or want to. And what we're saying is it's really important that you get the balance right. It's your product. You're curating this thing. This is part of the game. You can't just play the features part. You have to play the important features part. No, the non-functional, as they get called, but I don't like that phrase either. So, yeah, that was a whole set of OODA loops that we hadn't anticipated. I'd never anticipated. But they came out of an organizational cultural bug that we noticed.
It's interesting that this is something that we mentioned, we discussed before, and it's something I've stumbled across a lot, and really get it a lot whenever I'm running architecture-related workshops, is often there's a discussion, in fact, very, very common, where somebody sort of says, how do we work, effectively, let me sum it up as, how do we work around our product owner? In other words, and sometimes you can substitute other terms and roles, and normally it is because there is an implication in that term product owner that's quite deep, but actually most product owners are feature owners, exactly as you kind of described. They own the feature set. It's like kind of like a complex three-dimensional object, and they own the surface of it. And yet actually the product is all of this stuff that goes on inside. It's the whole making of it, maintaining it. It's its whole economic life cycle, its functionality, its tool, all of these things. Now, it doesn't mean they have to be an expert in it.
No.
And I often, I do some work for companies that in the medical space, and I often sort of say about them, I say, lovely developers. I wouldn't want a single one of them to be my doctor. But they have the expertise to build the products. That does not mean they are substitutable for a doctor. Mm. They are still the experts in this bit, which is, say, code, and they understand that, but they understand enough about the context to participate meaningfully in that.
Yeah.
And so I think that's that idea of trying to recognize the product owners need. You know, they're not on the outside.
And to that point, just to finish where I was going with the OODA loop, actually, because in that case, you're not really asking for action. Hmm. Because if you're asking for action on the technical product owner's position, you're asking for action in a degree with a high degree of ignorance. Hmm. And that's cruel.
Yeah.
So what we do is we're looking to what are the best conversations to enable between the engineering manager, the teams, and the product owner around these properties. So when we have a feedback loop that says that your product meets this bar for resilience that we can detect, what conversation are we looking to make happen? How do we surface that? Mm-hmm. Because again, culturally, you could surface it as governance. Mm-hmm. You could surface it, let's call it what it is, stick. Or you can surface it as carrot.
Yeah.
And we much prefer culturally to lean towards the carrot. There will be in the early days, perhaps in adoption, where stick needs to be used as another way to get it through. But we want to do it sensitively. So one of the things a product owner, a product steward, cares about is, do people understand their relationship with the product? So when I'm building a platform, and particularly with these product owners, I want them to love it. Mm. I want them to feel smarter, that they know that they are enabled to have these conversations. I want them to feel as good as I can get my engineering manager in the room, we can talk about something, and I'm not completely lost, and I'm not just saying, why is it not working, and why hasn't it got this feature or whatever. I can have a conversation that says, look, we're being told this, and this isn't where it could be or maybe should be, and so I can feel smart in that conversation, and I can ask questions like, well, what will that change? Yeah. And so that's the dynamic you aim for. Even if something is potentially governed, therefore you are being held potentially accountable for it, there is the desire from a product perspective to make that OODA loop empowering and to make you feel smarter for having it.
I think, put another way, I'm just thinking back to what you said before about those little two-way arrows. Mm. It's kind of like, what you're describing here is like, well, actually trying to give that meaning, but also I think, again, when we talk about diagrams and oversimplifications that are both necessary and problematic, is that when people draw diagrams, they draw it with respect to a software system, not with respect to the people. It's a point I've often noticed. Like, you've got these people, like they're spokes. stuck into the technology, whereas actually they're mostly talking to each other, or should be, and that, in other words, there needs to be an inversion here. It's like, what are the conversations, and exactly as you say, what's the flow, what are the loops that they are doing that should be improved, and then the technology fits inside that, rather than, you know, I'm going to plug you into, you are a human, I will plug you into this vast automaton.
Therefore, you'll be smarter, we'll be good. I've seen this a lot. Back in the day, I can remember we used to do rich pictures and things like this. I think it came under requirements gathering. But I used to love it. It was just sketches of what happens and who talks to who. These days, we've got much better approaches. So that I know there are talks here on systems thinking and how to look at these more complicated, stroke complex, possibly chaotic environments. I always recommend, I don't always get a lot of traction with this, but I always recommend people look into complexity theory and look into the work of Dave Snowden, and these days also into the work of Barry O'Reilly and residuality.
Yeah.
These are things that don't look obviously like something you should necessarily go and look at as a product owner or even as an engineer.
Yeah.
But they are so important because they're trying to remind you of the properties of the space you inhabit.
Yeah.
You look differently at the world. The world isn't always simple, very rarely simple, in fact, and basic. As soon as you've got people and machines and other things involved, you've got a space that you need to navigate and approach a certain way. And Dave Snowden stuff, I don't even want to go there to try and explain it because he's the expert, he could nail it. And it's
absolutely. If you're not familiar with Dave Snowden and Nevin and things like that,
go and look at it
online. You'll also learn a useful Welsh word as well, and that's where Nevin comes from.
It took a long time for me to realize that was how it was said.
Yeah.
And the beautiful part about it is that one of the things that Dave does talk about is looking for stories. So I mentioned stories yesterday. And I'm a writer, and Kevin's a much better writer than I.
No.
But as writers, no, anyone who can write fiction is up here. I do tech books. But when you look for how something will be experienced and the socio-technical side of it, stories, bizarrely, doesn't sound like the most important measure. But it is. And there's a great phrase I've heard Dave use. I'm probably simplifying it gratuitously. But this idea of when you're trying to change a system that is complex, such as lots of people involved, lots of tech involved, and there's lots of stuff going on around the outside, way beyond those little boxes in the middle. When you have that situation, ask yourself, better probably looks like more stories like this, less stories like that. And so you look to adjust the stories, and you look to elicit the stories, surface the stories as well as you can. There's a lovely book, I think, is it Linda Rising's On Change?
Yeah.
Fearless Change.
Fearless Change, Linda Rising, Marilyn Mads,
Yeah, fantastic book, because what it does is it tells you to go and talk to people, sit down, have a coffee.
Yeah.
The reason you do that is to hear the stories, because you want the real stories. It's all great to have the abstractions. You can have the personas. You can say, this is a platform engineer, and this is the two-way arrow. This is the engineering team, the product engineer, the product owners, and this is the two-way arrows for them. But when you got a person in front of you with a name and a history, and they've had a day, and they're going to tell you about their day, nothing is better than that. Those are the stories you can elicit, surface, and adjust and work with. So yeah, actually we found that with Wardley mapping too, just to quickly dive onto Wardley mapping. If you didn't catch Simon's talk yesterday on Wardley everything.
Yep, Wardley thinking.
Wardley thinking, it's always superb. Simon is brilliant, an amazing speaker. Wardley mapping itself is something we do. As product owners, I do a lot of Wardley mapping. And I've found it infinitely easier to do a Wardley map if I have a person at the top. My anchor on a Wardley map is a person with a name.
Yeah.
So I'm not just thinking generally what product people might need or what the engineers might need. I want to know what Donna needs. Or I want to know what Gabriel is worried about. And then we explore the tree from there. What needs do they have? And you end up with so much richer pictures of those needs and those connective tissue. Then you can look, okay, what are we looking to adjust? What are we looking to help with here? So yeah, Wardley mapping is fantastic, but we've seen enormous value when we give a real person as the anchor.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because it's that I remember really properly feeling that with a bit of tech coaching I did years and years ago. And finally, you know, it turned into non-tech coaching because I initially started with the developers, but then it was actually with the business analysts. And then we started drawing things, and I encouraged them to not just do the diagrams to the systems, but also to other people. But one of the BAs, she started sort of saying, well, hang on, who's this? That's so-and-so, and started drawing, you know, oh, she wears spectacles. So on the little figure, that's how you knew it was. So in other words, we made it incredibly real.
Yeah.
And we actually went and talked to people. It was a crazy idea, because that was not a thing that was done there, even though they were internal clients, and you didn't actually generally speak to them. And so there's that whole idea, this richness. But I think something else you're saying there is interesting, connecting back to the notion of complexity theory, Dave Snowden's work, the counterintuitiveness of Barry O'Reilly's stuff, because that's the point. It's basically saying, you know what, in a simple domain, things can be predictable and they can be worked on and they are highly deterministic and we can find rules and so on and live within that. Mm. And therefore, in that and related domains, there's this idea of like, oh yes, let's jump to measurement. And people, it's not that measurement is bad, but people jump to measurement before they have a story or any stories. And it's a case of often the people are looking for what can I measure rather than who are the people and what are they doing and why are they doing it and what do they believe. And that the stories idea, although it sounds kind of soft and fluffy, it's ridiculously hard, isn't it?
It's their reality.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one of the key skills, I didn't mention it yesterday particularly, I alluded towards the end, but I've recently been trained to do a volunteering job. And I'm on the phones to people who are in crisis. And I'm not the expert, right? By a long stretch, I can't know their world. I don't know what their day's been like. There's a complete stranger who's just called me. And my biggest fear with learning to do that was, what if I get bored? What if I can't understand them? What about if they're drunk? What about if they've got a strong accent? None of that matters. You are opening up a space where you intentfully, purposefully try to understand their world. And you're just trying, and you're putting them on center spotlight. It's all about them. Tell me what's going on. That has been enormous as a skill set to my job. Okay, it wasn't necessarily why I did it at all, but it is one of those things, and active listening is the general term for it, and it's one of those things that we call soft skills in this industry.
But they're really, yeah. Does anybody actually think soft skills are
soft
yeah, or easy? Let's do that. Who thinks soft skills are hard? Just raise your hands. Yeah. We are so bad at naming, aren't we? Yeah.
Soft, easy stuff, fluffy stuff.
Fluffy stuff is just no. The fluffy is so hard.
It's so skilled. And when I first met the first person who does this volunteering, it's the Samaritans organization. I think it's mostly UK based, and it's for anyone. Originally, it was for people who were potentially suicidal. But it's now for anyone from suicidal, if I'm getting this right from the calls I've had, to someone who's lost. Literally, the breadth of calls is enormous. But anyone in crisis at that moment. And when I first was considering doing it, I met somebody, not dissimilar from me, but somebody like yourself, actually, who exemplified listening. Just somebody that I'd never seen anybody leave a space after a sentence before they responded. I've worked in a lot of tech companies where I feel like it's just how can we fill the space with voice to be smart? And this guy sat there and there was a big room of people asking questions, and every time someone asked a question, he left the space. And then he answered. And it was beautiful because I could tell they felt listened to, and they had been, and he had really considered the next thing he was going to say. And I thought it was brave at the time, given the industry we work in and the meetings we have, where it's just like, let's get the quick stuff and let me talk at 90 miles an hour at you, and then let me wait for you to finish so I can say the next thing. This was the opposite. And this was beautiful. This was an opportunity to have new ideas and everything else that went with it. It's an astounding set of skills. So I don't know if you could ever get into that sort of thing in your own lives. And if you don't want to, I get it. It's a big commitment. I actually now do three things for the Samaritans. I do the phone calls, which is about 4 to 6 hours a week. I do the prison service, where I teach prisoners in UK prisons how to be listeners. And I'm also what they call a leader, which means that people are on the phones call me at the end of their shift to say this is what's happened to me, because it's an offload system. Mm. So a bit like draining a pump is what it's all about. You're draining the reservoir, the emotional resilience is recharged. But yeah, these skills are enormous as a product steward. I mean, they're enormous as a human being, but as a product steward, it's fantastic, because I know when every potential person who's using our platform, I have no idea what their life is like, what it's been like that day. And I don't go into any conversation thinking I do. Mm-hmm. And that's a reminder. I had to learn that, because I was always the expert, right? I've been 20 years in the industry. I'm brilliant at this. I never quite felt that out. But I've got all my baggage. I learned to suspend it. Mm-hmm. And you find out so much more when you're really listening. And I mentioned it yesterday, and it sounds like another woolly thing, another soft skill. But developing empathy and compassion to the people that are experiencing your products is where all the gold is. Because they don't just love the product, they love the people behind it. They need to understand the challenges you're facing when you're trying to create a platform. And you can't do that if you're looking at questionnaires, if you're looking at metrics.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can only do that when you sit down with them and say, right, how's it going? How's things for you at the moment? Is that problem, is that still gnarly? Is that still annoying you? Yeah, you know, that Terraform? No, I'm beating up on Terraform.
Yeah. but there's a really interesting side to that, which just called to mind that notion of we focus so much on quantitative approaches that, if you're ever after an alternative vocabulary to hard and soft, it is qualitative. I mean, yeah. Qualitative is the way that you frame it more positively. Mm. And although you're using the term woolly, and it just came to mind that actually wool is really hard. You know, it starts with sheep and it ends up with a whole load of other skills. It's surprisingly hard. All of these things that we use as metaphors, when we scratch their surface, there's normally, I think there's something that we miss. We do oversimplify. It turns out that woolly is a much more sophisticated metaphor than we give it credit for. And likewise, architecture is more sophisticated. Yeah. And people are ultimately messy and sophisticated and filled with stories.
They are, and fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, back to my point of I thought I'd be bored. You're never bored. I can have someone on the phone that's describing their world, and it can potentially, from an objective position, it can be a very straightforward situation. But when they unpack how they feel about it and how it's come about and everything that's gone with it, we use a metaphor for empathy, and it may be one you've heard before, so apologize if you've already seen this, but it's a comparison with sympathy. So sympathy gets a bad rap, but it's not the end of the world. I mean, at least you're sympathetic. Okay, there are some people, ex-presidents, that maybe don't lack some of the sympathy. I just take sympathy from some people. But the idea is that if someone's in their world, right, so say, go back to technology and your platforms. If you're building a platform as a product, you're talking to someone, they're finding something difficult. They're living down a hole, and they're frustrated. They're beating up against the sides of the wall. They're possibly going home grumpy. They're probably talking to their friends about you, about what it is. You know, and you get all of that picture. A sympathetic person will be at the top of the hole looking down going, oh, it's a shame. And then, you know, oh, well, we've got something on the roadmap. You know, that sort of response. That's sympathy at best. Empathy is always described as climbing down the hole, sitting with them in that hole, looking at those walls that they're pounding their fists against. And going, oh, okay, I get some of how this feels. And in that process, people think about empathy being the result. It's not always the most important result. Mm-hmm. It's the process of doing it builds a relationship with a person, with a potential person who's going to thrive with your product, where you'll begin to have rapport and trust, all the things you want them to feel of the product you build. So never underestimate the importance of being a technical product owner or steward. That is, you're fronting the product. Your values and how you operate represents how the product will be perceived. the best example of this is back in the day when we saw, you know, Steve Jobs on stage talking about the latest incredibly expensive device that you can't afford. But you wanted to, because it was counterculture, right? Steve doesn't play by the rules. Well, he pretty much did, but they didn't play by the rules. And you bought into that, right? Because it was great. I know many people who bought Apple Kit because of that feeling, because it was him doing it. And it's changed since then. You as a product owner are part of the product. And that's a great place to be, a very empowering place to be. And so getting out there and developing those empathetic relationships, you're also explaining why the product is the way it is to people.
Yeah. Now, I am keenly aware of the time, because actually I could do this for another couple of hours. Mm. This is why we still have phone calls. We have these, you know, Zoom calls every now and then. Yeah, we could do this for hours, but I want to make sure that we get some other voices in here. Are there any questions from the floor? Because honestly, we could do this all day.
It's a smile.
Apparently, there's another conference going on in the same building that we have to attend, you know.
I have a question. So it sounds like an amazing environment to work in, you know, like platform engineering being what you described in the beginning. But there seem to be people who don't want to let go of the tech, even though I know it would be a bright future for them. But they are holding on, right, to policies and architecture diagrams. So how do you inspire that? How do you inspire the people in the system to wanting an other system? Because I struggle a lot with that.
I think that's a lovely way of phrasing it. Yeah.
Yes, it is. And it's... there's a lovely book called Switch, right? And I'm not going to say all books solve everyone's problems, because they don't. But the book Switch is interesting, because it's all about how change happens. And there's a metaphor in it that I really love. It's the elephant and the rider, okay? So everybody has these two forces in their head, is the kind of story. And if you go into those people and you say, look, this is better, this is quantitatively, measurably better, it's going to be, you're speaking to the rider, and the rider's going, I get you, but I don't feel that. So you have to appeal to the elephant. The elephant is going to go whatever way it wants, and hopefully occasionally will listen to the rider. If you've ever ridden an elephant on holiday or vacation, I went to a sanctuary once, that was a wonderful experience, but yeah, they've got a little pole. They just tap. There's no way the elephant cares. Right? And I was on an elephant that decided there was a shortcut. And it took it. That rider, despite many protestations, was not changing this elephant's mind. And that's what you're dealing with there. When you hit that resistance of, I want this to be about the tech, that's because it's safe. And so what you do is you try and make the other piece really safe. So that's why I like using the OODA loops, and I do actually explain them as OODA loops for people, and I use Wardley maps. Even if the answer's obvious, even if I sit there and go, I think I know what this is supposed to be, sometimes I'm wrong, I'm surprised. But if I take those people, put the effort investment into them being in the room, when we explore it in more detail, and they start to see that tech is a small piece of the picture that we're trying to build, and then I spend lots of time communicating that picture over and over again. And it's a lovely phrase from Michael Nygaard's talk yesterday, where he said, when you're bored of explaining something, they're just getting it. I thought that was spot on. There's so many speakers that fall into this trap, by the way. We do our talks and we think everyone just knows what we've talked about. The world knows now. And then, you know, you see talks like today where someone's going, I've just done the last talk, same talk for 15 years, and they're still not getting it. I love that, because it's true. And so an enormous amount of time and effort goes into communicating in various ways, using different metaphors sometimes. I used the ski resort one yesterday. I have a bunch of others that sort of work. Ski resort seems to work best, but some people don't get it because they're not skied. I get it. We can find another one. So yeah, so that there's no easy answer on it, I'm afraid. But when the answer's tech, I usually go, that's great, but that you do realize that is feeding in, I probably don't always say it like this, but the danger is that's a simple and basic answer in a complex environment. Therefore, it has as much likelihood to be wrong as anything else. And so what you do is go, okay, one of the things I talk about actually briefly in the talk is using experiments. So I might say to someone like that, okay, that's great. You think the answer is Pulumi. right? It's just the answer. I've had this recently. The answer's Pulumi. What's the question? Nothing against Pulumi. But it's a complex socio-tech environment. A lot of factors, a lot of moving parts. We can do an experiment. We can see if it sinks, swims here. And that's usually the context bit I try and bring to people, is that it might be objectively the right answer. Does it sink or swim here is always more interesting. Does that help at all? Thank you very much for your question.
Brilliant, thank you. We have time for just one more question, I think, if there is anybody who would like to ask a question.
I love the way everyone just looks at each other.
Yeah, otherwise you're leaving it to me to sort of ask a question and then close the talk. In which case, so I'm going to come back to it, because we've kind of danced around it a little bit. Your talk was also very personal yesterday. Mm. And that was one of the kind of outstanding elements of it, but also being able to draw the connections to trying to create product and being responsible for that. Mm. So in other words, that was going back to what I was saying, this is a very human side of understanding the role of platform and what you can offer and that bigger perspective. So here in 2024, if you know, the usual 10-year in reverse thing, 2014, Russ in 2014, what did he not know
that you... Anything.
That you know, if you had to kind of encapsulate.
What a brilliant question. Yeah. Thanks, my friend. Okay, so first of all, Russ in 2014 was burning out. He was working every hour on things that didn't matter much. I was writing many books. I'm very thankful I wrote the books, but I probably shouldn't have done it as intensely as I did. I was almost certainly... I had a very toxic relationship to an awful lot of properties in life. The realization since then, the growth since then is massive. Okay, I can't explain it any other way. It's a bit of a cliche. I was talking to some lovely folks earlier about it. It's a bit of a cliche to say, you know, you get a critical illness and then you become a cliche. That's how it works. But I did. I got this gift. I know it's a very strange word for it, but I would never wish to give this gift to anybody else. But you get this thing, and you get this moment where everything gets thrown into very stark relief, and you grow. And you know, I found out that I have a very dark sense of humor when life is threatened. I'm great in a crisis. I will find the funny side, which is terrible in incidents, by the way. It's not what people want as a joke. But that to me is the big growth. I can now look back and go, I did not know why I was here then. Mm. I was thrashing around, working on everything, trying desperately to do something with my life. I got the opportunity to go, what am I here for? It's an incredible question. I recommend everyone consider it. Please don't wait for cancer to do it. It's much better beforehand. And then you can channel yourself into something that really, really matters. And I had this conversation with my friends recently, actually. Karina was one of the people I mentioned in my first slide. She's the friend that beefed me up before my talk. Karina is currently working in a job where she feels a little bit undervalued. She's not doing as much interesting work as she'd like. And we've just spent time going, well, what do you love? What are you here for? How do we inject that into your day job? How do we find that in your day job? Turns out a day job really needs it. The things she cares most about, they really need. But no one had that conversation because she had never brought it to them. And I do the same. Whenever I join a company, I'm very clear, this is what I'm here for. There's a mission. Okay, I'm here to help people make their lives better. If I can't do that here, I will go somewhere else and do it. But yeah, that I wish I'd known that many, many years ago. And I'm so glad I do now.
Russ, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.